This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you're listening to Core Brain Journal. It's the place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street. Well, welcome, folks. Dr. Charles Parker back again. This is episode 037. And what we're doing at Core Brain Journal today is we've invited Dr. Chris Martinson to join us. And I'm so excited I can hardly get his name out because the guy is a very, very interesting guy that everybody here will love listening to. He has so many interesting things to talk about, from neurotoxins, which are going to be on the brain side, all the way up to the future of mankind. He's going to cover a lot. How can we do it in a half an hour? Don't ask me that question. So, Chris, welcome aboard.
Chuck, it's a real pleasure to be here with you and your listeners.
Thanks for coming. So, here's the deal. What we wanted to do is to introduce you a little bit and talk about your background, and then we'll find out a little more about you on a personal level. So, Chris is a PhD from Duke and an MBA from Cornell. He's an economic researcher and futurist specializing in energy and resource depletion. He's the co-founder of Peak Prosperity.com. And as one of the early econobloggers, he forecasted the housing market collapse and the stock market correction years in advance. Chris rose to prominence with the launch of his seminal video seminar, The Crash Course, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And it has also been published in book form. And he's extremely well regarded as a person who distills the interconnected forces in the economy, energy, and the environment. He calls them the three E's that are shaping the future of mankind. And he also has a new book out, which we're going to be talking about as well. And he's actually going to offer it as a drawing to our group here. And it's called Prosper: How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting. Very interesting. So thank you again, Chris, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about yourself personally, if you will, and then we'll go on and talk a little more about these interests of yours.
Well, sure. Let's start with today. I'm 53. I have three mostly grown children, and I've been doing what I currently do for about 10 years. Before we get into that, my background, as you mentioned, I started in science. I love science. I was playing around mostly in the cell biology labs at Duke University, did my postdoc there as well. Being kind of slow in some ways, I love teaching, Chuck. I just loved it. And I got into the whole thing to teach, and I discovered way late in the game that major research universities don't care if you're a great teacher or not. It's not part of the game.
Yeah.
And sure, I watched these junior faculty people who I thought were amazing not get tenure, and I watched these people who I thought, in my judgment, were socially inept getting tenure, and the game was, can you bring in grants? And I looked at that game, and I and hard, and I'd spent a lot of time grabbing for the brass ring. And this was in the mid-90s when I was graduating. And I got to tell you, the opportunities to teach at the non-major research university were horrible. 400 applicants for every job, starting salaries of around $33,000 a year. I looked at all that and said, no, I don't know. This doesn't. That was sort of weighing on me, but I was at this party, and all these junior faculty were there, and I realized, and I'm very interested in lots of things, Chuck, and I'm at this party, and I realized that people, like, if I'm talking with somebody, and if I could talk with them about the internal sulfur bond on a G-protein coupled signal receptor, gosh, they were all over it, because that's what they were interested in, but nothing else. They had no other interest in life, politics, you know, art, religion, nothing else was on their radar screen, and I said, that's not me. I'm an expansive person, not a narrowing individual. And I had to walk from that and took a hard right and went into business and spent about almost 10 years in various corporate functions, ending up at vice president of a fairly large health sciences division at SAIC. And right around 2001, here's the transformation story. My portfolio was getting shredded like everybody's, my personal savings. And I started looking into, for the first time, what really was happening in the stock market. And within a short matter of months, I scared myself silly with what I was discovering. One thing led to another. And before long, I found myself unable to continue in my current job doing what I was doing at a major corporation. I was 42 at that time. I quit the job. I left that. I started a blog. And so nobody should talk to me for career advice. I'm terrible. But I really did. I chucked everything away in order to pursue my passion, which was I wanted to tell people about the changes I saw coming. I didn't have a sense of how it would become a business. I'm quite fortunate to tell you it's become a rather wonderful business. My mission and money are aligned. And I get to now travel the world telling people about these really big, kind of uncomfortable changes that are coming.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. Yeah, so let's talk a little bit before we get into those uncomfortable changes, which we're all eager to hear about because we got to fasten our seatbelts. But let's talk a little bit about your background. We are Core Brain Journal, and you know, you had some very interesting papers that we're going to put in the show notes. And honestly, you had some very significant words that were completely out of my vocabulary, like acrylamide and... let's see if I can even pronounce it. Calmodulin dynamics mm-hmm. within the hippocampal cells. Just tell us a little bit about what you're doing. You don't need to go that deep because we probably wouldn't get it if you told us. So, but what were you interested in back when you were doing neurotoxicology?
Well, you know, Chuck, people think biological sciences are enormously advanced, but you could spend about 6 months digging in any direction and get to the edge of what we know. So I was really trying to understand how neurons work. In particular, the acrylamide is a compound. It's a very simple compound. People use it in acrylamide gels, for instance, to separate proteins and do things. Very common lab chemical. It's also a neurotoxin, and it's a peripheral neurotoxin, and specifically it causes dieback of the axonal projections. And so I was interested in understanding how it was that nerves both grow and find their way along and create these distal axons out through the body. And there's a couple ways you can do that. You can study healthy cells, but of course that's hard. And so we used neurotoxic chemicals and neuromimetics that would come in and wreck the cells. It's kind of like if you want to know how a Lamborghini works, but you're 500 feet in the air. Well, one thing you can do is you can drop a big rock on it, smash it apart, and look at the pieces. That's really what the toxic chemicals I was testing were doing, were interfering with normal cell processes in ways that mimicked disease states that we knew about out there, peripheral neuropathies, ALS, possibly MS, but I think not at this point, but I think ALS possibly still, and certain other fairly rare neuronal diseases. So I was breaking cells to figure out how they worked, and I got to work in a lab where we used living cells in living culture with very, very high-powered differential interference contrast microscopes and fluorescent microscopes so we could watch living cells in real time as they were reacting. Very exciting. Loved the work.
Mm. That would be so beautiful, I can imagine. I mean, the phosphorescence and the whole thing, it'd be very, very interesting. So what were some of the conclusions you reached from those studies that might be applicable to what we're doing today?
Well, you know, really the department I got my degree through, because there isn't a department of toxicology at Duke when I was there, it was housed with biology. So I'll tell you, as a pathologist, I perform a lot of postmortems today, but they're on the economy. And really, I developed this overwhelming sense of the beauty and complexity. To see a living cell, if I could explain this to your listeners, to see even just like a regular hepatocyte or a keratinocyte or something, just a regular cell flattened out living, it looks like a city from 10,000 feet. There's vesicles moving everywhere. It's just full of dynamic action. These microscopes I was working with could even image microtubules, you know, down to 25 nanometers width. Astonishing. We could see all of this, and to see an individual living cell in its complete complexity actually was a fairly profound, if not sacred, experience for me. It was astonishing. And from that, I carried a real humility about what it is that we're going to be capable of knowing yet. You know, a lot of people think, oh my gosh, humans, we've got technology that's amazing. We know so much. I could show you a single cell and tell you, nah, we still don't know all that much yet. We know a lot. But oh my gosh, I became very humble through that experience.
I can certainly understand that. It's funny, when you look out into the heavens, you go one way, and you look down in the cells, it's the same thing. I mean, there's so much we don't know.
Absolutely. And it is fractal like that. We're learning more and more as the sciences dig deeper. They're, of course, circling back around to things that do become sacred, more spiritual questions. The things that physicists are discovering are just such head scratchers. You either ignore them, or if you really look at them, they're saying some fairly profound things about the nature of reality and our role in all of that. So for me, the science, reductionist as it was actually a path back to a greater appreciation of the wonder of it all.
Well, you know, it sounds like your passion for that, those many processes and looking at them, and your awareness of the destructive potential of some of the things you were working with may have been part of the impetus for you to move further into what's going on with the larger society anyway. I don't know if there was a connection there or not.
Well, it did. One thing led to another. So let me fast forward. The business I'm in now is about connecting fairly disparate topics. So my scientific background, very helpful. I love data. I'm always crunching around. Tell me what the numbers are. My business gave a really good grounding in storytelling, right? Having the data is one thing, but communicating it's the other. So I had both of those skills. And as well, the pathology taught me everything is gray. There's no black and white, right? Someone comes up and says, hey, my uncle smokes 4 packs a day. Is he going to get lung cancer? And I'll say, maybe, right? So I know the statistics of the world. And it was my natural science background that really got me to understand and look at humans as an organism, where we are in this particular part of the human story. We're alive at one of the most amazing and also threatening times ever to be alive. I was born in 1962, 3 billion people on the planet. If I live to a ripe old age, there will be 9 billion when I check out. I will have lived through a full tripling of the population at a time when every major resource we know about that we as organisms depend on, which is soil, water, and fuel, the energy that we live on, all of those will be past peak. And this is a period nobody else has lived through, although we can look at smaller subsets of cultures that ruined their soils and what happened to them or ran out of water or things like that. So it's an astonishing time to be alive. They're both enormous challenges and really exceptional opportunities. And that's the story I'm telling today. So it does all connect back. I needed the storytelling, the data, the ability to communicate, which was my teaching background. I've kind of landed my lap. I looked at it one day and I said, if I don't do this, who will?
Yeah. Oh. And you had the curiosity about it, and you had the ability to make the connections between these disparate organisms, if you will.
Yeah, I'm a curious guy, and one of my favorite quotes is from Leonardo da Vinci, and he said, "Learn to see, understand that everything is connected to everything else." So I talk to economists, and they're brilliant, and they know their differential equations, and they understand all of their Taylor rules and all this stuff, but they've never lifted their heads up and asked the most fundamental question of them all, which is infinite growth possible on a finite planet? I say no. I think sixth graders would say no. I think anybody with a crayon and a half a brain and a napkin can say no. But the economists have never thought it through. They don't care. All they want is growth for growth's sake. Growth is all they need. They have everything's about growth. And I'm trying to get that crew to talk to the people who understand and come from the world of energy, for instance, or from the environment. Those three E's need to be in dialogue with each other, and they're not. And that's something that's very troubling to me and to people who do come across this material, look at it, and conclude, yes, we ought to have some other dialogue around this and maybe even some other plans in place besides we're going to grow forever or face a collapsing banking system. You know, that really seems to be the choice we're faced with right now, and that's uncomfortable to me at best.
Well, so how did you put that together? I mean, this is terribly interesting and maybe not germane directly to brain function, but hey, if we're alive, we have a brain. If we're dead, it's going to be gone. So let's really talk a little more about your the way you began to develop how you're going to communicate that. And I think a place to drive a little closer from my reading of your bio is that whole crash course. Was it a video course or what happened with that?
Well, it's a book and a video course. We've got a fairly short version of it and a really long form version of it, all divided out into easy chapters. So however people like to consume it, we've got it. It's in 12 languages now, thanks to volunteers around the world. So it really, Chuck, I thought it was going to be a disaster. Look, I sat down with a bunch of PowerPoint slides and talked over them. It's some dude's voice and a bunch of graphs, right? And it really took off and got a lot of views and a lot of attention. And this, as I mentioned, the translators putting a lot of time. It took about 1,200 hours on average for somebody to translate this. So it was a big effort. And so people took that up because they felt it was important. What I was doing was I was simply giving context, both explanatory and predictive power, for where we are in this story today that made more sense to people than what they are reading in the newspaper or hearing on TV, because I'm just putting reality out there, right? As far as best I know it. And so this does come back to brain function, though, because what I learned, I thought I was sharing information all that time, and I realized that information, about 0.5% of the population can digest and change from information alone, right? There's humans change through two paths, pain and insight, right? Now, pain is the more common path. Insight is a very narrow path. I have a lot of, like, the people who are attracted to my website, doctors, lawyers, engineers, typically. People who are numerate and trained in some rational art, and they get it right away. But because people change through pain, it doesn't mean they're slower or less adept or somehow, you know, have picked the wrong path. I change through pain, too. And what the pain route tells us is that we go down that route when one of our belief systems needs to change, right? So once I had all this data and it was sort of, you know, relevant and some people were gravitating to it, my next question is, how do I get to more people? Well, now I had to take a tour through things like behavioral economics. I had to understand grief processing, the emotional pathway to changing how people will interpret and digest information. And so the crash course itself was a bunch of stuff jumbled into a big, long series. And after I understood, had this insight about how I could get more people to change, I understood Kubler-Ross's, you know, five stages of grief as a way of just saying, listen, anytime somebody's belief systems get shaken, whether it's their belief in public education or it's their belief in their mortality, it's an emotional process, Chuck, that they go through in order to modify that change. So how do you do that? Well, now the crash course, if you look at it, you'll say, wow, I see he started with money and went through this and started talking about that. It's all organized now according to my best understanding of having the easiest, most lightly held belief systems at the front of the story. And I build credibility by challenging those carefully. And then by the end, we get to the big, hairy, most deeply rooted beliefs people might hold. And if I started on those, that would be a jarring process. I would lose a lot of people right away. Yep. And so here's an example. Towards the end of the crash course, you'll find me talk about how government statistics are, I call it fuzzy numbers, and that's being kind. They're really heavily, heavily distorted and often don't even comport with reality. And they're more political than truthful at this point in time. And so I could prove that to people by saying, here's your real inflation experience. Here's what they're telling you it is through the government. They don't line up well, do they? But when I'm doing that, I'm not challenging people's faith in inflation statistics. I'm challenging their faith in authority, which is deeply ingrained in us from school. Right? On through at all levels of our society. So I carefully handle that topic towards the end because I don't want to challenge somebody and lose them at the front end. My story is too important to bobble. Mm-hmm. So that's one example of how I am using what we know now about how we're wired, about how our amygdala feeds into our brain. I have great information from neurobiologists about associative pathways, about mirror neurons, I have all this understanding of what it takes to tell a story in a way so that I don't accidentally lose somebody for a reason that's avoidable.
Very interesting. Yes. So, you know, while you're talking, I'm taking this trip with you. There's so much parallels, if I can say the word, parallels what we're doing here, because Core Brain Journal is stuck in the same place. One of the people I like, and you probably know him, is Dr. Edward De Bono, mm-hmm. who is one of the leading individuals who studies creativity and thinking out of the box. And one of his favorite phrases that I like is that pulls the two issues together is excellent but not enough. You know, So what happens is there's a little credible value to what's going on. But if it's not enough, we're going to have to start thinking about what's going to happen next.
Well, interesting. My phrase, which I came across rather in parallel, but accidentally, is necessary but insufficient.
Yes, right.
There's a lot of things we're doing that are necessary, but they're still insufficient. So we need these big, bold, crazy ideas to come along. And in particular, young people are going to be the holders of those ideas. And if we have a culture that punishes mistakes or being wrong, we're not going to get the kind of wild out-of-the-box thinking that's necessary to really do things. Because let me be clear, where we are in the story right now, we're not going to elect the right person in at this point that's really going to change things. When we look at where we are in the energy story, we need an Apollo mission times a Manhattan Project times some large whole number like 10, and we have to get dead serious about this. And I'm worried we won't until we get to the next crisis. But then, of course, people go, crisis is no time to try crazy stuff. So I'm a little worried about the path we're on. And my question is, and I'd love to hear your take on this, is what do we need to do to begin to change the larger narrative in time? Because we don't need new technology. We have everything we need. We're not using it. So it's not about the technology. It's about how we become urgent enough to begin daring to do the things that we need to do.
Well, it's a little bit pessimistic, but you already know the answer, and that is we're going to be in some doggone pain that's going to wake everybody up. And the question is, where's it going to come from first?
Well, absolutely. And that was really the impetus for the Crash Course is the problem definition book. And the second one is Prosper is the solution space. And that's co-authored with Adam Taggart. And together, he's my co-partner at Peak Prosperity. We hold seminars, weekend long seminars, and we have lots of people at our website. And we're asking this question, how should we be given the state of the world? What are the things that we could be doing? And we think it's like you and I just talked about, we think it's a fractal story. And we start with that fractal story at this level of the individual. Here's our theory. If you as an individual are resilient and happy and healthy, and then your family is happy and healthy and resilient, you put enough families together, you have a resilient community, enough of those, you have a resilient state, enough of those, a resilient country, and so on. So we think it starts, we don't work at the national policy level. We work with the individuals and individual corporations, people, things like that as much as possible. And Prosper answers this question. People look at the state of the world when they really dare peek at the data we've got and they go, oh my gosh, it's really going to change, maybe disruptively. What do I do? And so usually the first place people ask that question is economically. I love starting with economics, your personal finances. Everybody's got a pocketbook or a wallet. Everybody cares about it. And it doesn't matter if you're Hindu, Christian, old, young, right, left on the political spectrum. It's non-denominational in every way. We start there. But if you have financial capital, you know, none are so poor as those who only have money. It's good to have it, but financial capital alone is not going to be sufficient in this story. So we have seven other forms of capital arrayed around that. Some are quite recognizable, like material capital, like having a nice house that's well insulated would be part of your material capital. Wonderful. Living capital, having some things growing outside of your house that you can eat, having high quality nutrition or your state of health of your body. Having living capital, of course, wonderful, good to have. But I'll tell you, the most important piece of capital out of the eight, I think, is emotional capital. And if people are not resilient and able to change readily, they're going to have not only a crappy potential future, but today is going to be hard on them. So we spend an increasing amount of time asking the question, how can we build up our emotional capital? It's a very, very big, deep field. It's something I'm personally interested in working on. And everything that I write about is something that has been a personal journey. I do not study and then write about stuff. I live it and then write about it. So the whole book of Prosper is really Adam and my own personal journey of how can we make ourselves as resilient as possible. Total honesty, I started this journey out of fear, like, uh-oh, bad stuff coming. And now I would run towards this life, Chuck, because I'm happier, I'm healthier, I've got richer social networks. I feel like I've stumbled across something my great-grandfather would know all about. He's like, oh, yeah, you're just living now. That's cool. But in our culture, it's really an act of rebellion to eschew the consumptive, you know, high standard of living lifestyle, which I've willingly done, but I couldn't be happier with how my quality of life has increased.
So you had that recognition of where you were going even back when you were in corporate, before you went to the farm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was a part of it, but it was very roughly formed at that point in time. It's definitely gelled and changed a lot over time.
So what happened to the farm is you really changed your reality in a way that synchronizes you personally with the cycles of nature, with the reality of what's going on with the rain, the chickens, you know, life and death. And it keeps you honest in a way with what's going on, as opposed to chasing the dream.
Yeah, I'm definitely closer, but I'm not by any stretch pure about this. I recognize living in the United States, my level of consumption, even dialed back, is an order of magnitude higher than other parts of the world. I get to live a very high standard of living by most of the world's standards. That's a wonderful thing. And I know we need to do more. We myself. So it's really not a place you get to. It's more of a journey that I'm on. And yes, I love being connected back to the rhythms of nature. I love eating and growing my own food. I love the fact that my 15-year-old daughter can gut a chicken faster than anybody else I know, and she's proud of it too. But she'll blend in with any crowd at the mall. I mean, I love having these new skills. That's me. But for me, if I'm not learning, growing, and changing, I'm really unhappy. And in our seminars, we find a lot of people, Chuck, they show up and they say, "Oh, I see that life you've got. Let me tell you, I'm working as an engineer over here at Boeing. But you know, my daughter's just about to graduate high school, and then I've got college. I feel trapped." People tell me all the time they feel like they're leading two lives. They have the life they're actually leading, and then there's this other one that they wish they were leading. The one they're on is good and it pays well, but it's not fulfilling in some deep level. And I think that the state of the world today, my theory, is that people are looking at the state of the world and saying, "I want to fit in a way that feels meaningful to me and like I'm really contributing towards making this a better place," and not everybody's there yet. A lot of people really aren't. So there's general levels of anxiety out there. It's in our statistics. It's in the obesity levels in this country. It's in the fact that suicide overtook car accidents as the leading non-natural cause of death in this country. It's in all kinds of statistics around psychoactive drug use, opiate, all this stuff. These are all, to me, symptoms of a culture of people who are saying, "Help, I'm a little bit unhappy here." And so really this larger story of, look, the world's gonna change anyway, possibly disruptive, here's the data, becomes an invitation to say, "Hey, why wait for that? Why don't I re-examine my life today and make my own choices about how I wanna live for myself today?" And that's really the help in the practice that I find most invigorating at this point.
Very, very interesting. Now, let me ask you a question, because as you're speaking, I'm developing a greater curiosity. I know that you did a presentation for the UN and the UK House of Commons. So what is your message when you personally go in there with that group of individuals? And how do you articulate this to them? And what's your structure for that presentation?
Well, I really go right for the jugular. I'm not there to scare people, but I'm not there to try and get invited back. So I don't water my presentation down. I just give the data. I say, "Look, we have an exponential money system, and exponential systems are simply any system which is growing by some percentage over a unit of time. It could be 1% a year, it could be 50% a minute, doesn't matter. So we have an exponential money system. Our credit is compounding at about 8% per year globally, and it has for 30 years. That means that roughly every 9 years, our credit system is going to fully double. And it's currently at $200 trillion. If I was giving the presentation today, I would say that means that the world's expectation is that in the next 9 years, we're going to double that to $400 trillion, and then 800, and then 16. So let's stop for a second. What are we going to spend all that money on? Because money only has utility if it's in relation to real things, which is the world. Now wander with me over to the world for a second. It's out of exploitable new fisheries. In fact, they're in decline. It's out of new arable acres that we can turn under and begin growing on. We've mined the soils for all of the key nutrients, and we're replacing them with using fossil fuels. On and on and on down this big laundry list. It's when we put these two pieces together, which is a money system that requires infinite growth and a world that no longer can sustain that pattern, That's a collision course. And so I invite people who are in leadership positions, you have to begin wrestling with this as an idea. I don't have the easy answers for you, but if you're managing a pension or an endowment with a 50-year horizon, you have to know about this information and begin thinking about it. If you're trying to manage a country for the long term, you have to know about this. And what's fascinating, when I go to the UN, the people who are most acutely aware of this, who have the best handle on this, are the Chinese.
Is
absolutely
right?
Hands down.
Very
oh, yes.
What's your opinion about why that is?
Well, everybody I talk to who's made it up through the Chinese leadership are all extremely well-educated. Everybody is a subject matter expert in their field. They're just loaded to the gills with PhDs, mathematicians, economists, architectural engineers, you name it. Almost no lawyers have sort of rounded out the top of the leadership structure. So they get it. Two years ago, China said, we want to get into alternative energy big time. They committed $800 billion program over 10 years, $80 billion a year to that. The United States has about $1 billion a year going towards this right now. They are now currently the world leader in alternative energy, because when I sit down and talk with them, in the United States, I have to do all this convincing. Let me show you how much neodymium there is in the world. Let me show you how much oil there is. Let me show you rare materials. The Chinese get it. They're like, stop. You don't have to tell us any of that. We know, we can see the future where oil runs out, where the rare earth elements run out, where these things run out. We have to get to an energy infrastructure that looks like this before then we get it. In this country, we haven't even started that conversation.
That is terribly interesting. I was totally surprised by that piece of information. And it's great, because you're saying something about the people we choose to lead us, you know, and what we're actually following and who we're listening to.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's interesting. It was just 3 months ago here in June. So this was just, I guess, back early March, maybe. The director of the national grid in China, so this is a person who oversees the entire grid, very, very prominent person, came out and put a thought bomb out there and said to the world, we have to get serious about this. We need a global energy grid where we would put wind towers up there in the Arctic, and we would put solar plants over here in the desert, and we need an international grid. We've calculated it. We think it's going to take $50 trillion of investment. We should have started 20 years ago, but we need to do this. It was a very serious proposal. It landed like all you heard was chirping crickets out of the rest of the world, but it's exactly the only sort of alternative energy program that could actually meet the challenge that we face of replacing fossil fuels, maybe not just for climate change reasons, but just because they're going to run out and it's in decades, it's not in hundreds of years. I hate to say it. So that's the kind of a proposal that somebody who's numerate gets the scope and the scale of the challenge, as well as the time and the cost involved. It was a very, you know, it was a kind of a huge, gigantic, hand-wavy proposal, but it was in the arena of plausible of numbers that make sense to me.
That's pretty terrifying, no question about it. Start thinking about decades, that's a short time away. I mean, I won't be here in decades, but you will. And your kids will, and our kids will. My grandchildren will be. You know, it's a short period of time before we hit the wall.
Well, it is, and the data's all right there, and this isn't, there's days I wake up, Chuck, and I wish I sold pet rocks instead of what I currently do, but, you know, I put the data out there, and we have a machine in this country that's heavily invested in selling the opposite side of this story. So your listeners would be forgiven if they're confused and say, but wait, Obama said we have 100 years of natural gas. And it's not true. And we don't have time to go into why it's not true, but it's utterly false. And people go, oh, but we're discovering shale oil all the time. But if we could just sit down and I could show you the data on it, I'd say, yeah, it's there. It's wonderful. It's a resource, no question, but it's not infinite. Here's how much there is. It'll last this long. So, you know, what I did in business when I was in my business side of life was I did a lot of strategy development. And there's all these fancy strategy methods you could learn, but they all boil down to this. Where are we going? How are we going to get there? What's the vision? What are the resources we have? That's it. Those two elements. So if we had a competent strategy in the United States, we'd say, great, we have all this energy. That's the resource. Where do we want to be in 30 years, right? And instead, I open up the newspaper, they're like, woohoo, cheap gas, and we sold more F-150 trucks than we did last quarter. You know, we're on the path to recovery. I'm like, no, we're not. We're headed in the wrong direction. You know, what we need is a whole new energy approach, and that's a really big topic, and it's just one of the ones I cover, but it just points to this idea. that the data is there and it has nothing to do with the data. Because if it did, we'd be doing something else. So the question again before me is, how do we change the narrative that says we need to be doing things differently? Not out of fear, but because we could have a higher quality, better future if we did that. More jobs, people would be interested. Take our best and brightest. Don't send them to Wall Street to play money games against each other. Send them over here to Elon Musk's, you know, side of the equation. And let's build out towards this future that we can believe in. And that's how I analyze this political climate. I see young people in particular who gravitated to Bernie Sanders saying, stop. We don't want any more of that status quo baby boomer mentality. Can we have something different, something I can believe in? And what they know better than anybody, I talk to college students all the time, Chuck, they get it. They're like, this path we're on, I don't see how it doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for anybody, but it doesn't work for me, and we're persisting with it. How do I engage with that? And many of them don't. They say, screw it, I'm not doing that.
This is a very interesting problem because you're on a mission of one or two, and you're creating a group of people, attempting to create a group of people who converse effectively about this. Do you cover some of this at peakprosperity.com?
Absolutely.
Videos? I haven't visited the site. Do you have videos over there? What would a person find when they go to Peak Prosperity?
Well, first, there's a very large community there of people who come and we talk about these things. And, you know, we've got a subscription side of the site, and then almost all of it, 90%+ of it's free. And we have one site that's dedicated to talking through the world events as they're unfolding, economic stuff, energy stuff, environmental stuff. And then we have another site dedicated to just what do you do about it. So a lot of material there. But if I was going to direct somebody who was curious at this point, you would go to peakprosperity.com/ACC. That's Apple Charlie Charlie. Mm-hmm. And that gets you to something called the Accelerated Crash Course. There's a video there. It's 52 minutes long. And it puts all of this into one little blob. From there, you would then follow other links is according to your interest. Do you want to learn more? Would you like to get busy doing something? Is there something you want to talk about? So really, if I could define the people at my site, it would be a word you already used, and that's curious. We're just curious about all of this stuff. And, you know, new data comes in all the time, and hopefully that helps us, you know, rethink our positions, and we're learning all the time. So it's a real community of curious people who are also concerned about the direction of things.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on. You know, it's been a revelation for me, and I'm sure for many of our listeners, because, you know, we started out in brain and we went really down to some very organic variables that are going to affect all of our lives in the future. And I really appreciate your sharing that with us. And, you know, it's just been a very interesting conversation. It makes me want to run over to the website right now and listen to that 52-minute video, because it's going to be interesting. I just think this conversation with you has been so so fascinating, so interesting. I really appreciate it.
Well, Chuck, thank you for the opportunity. And, of course, as you can detect, this is my passion.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Chris Martinson. Thanks for listening to Core Brain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications, like those written for ADHD, are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.